This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we continue looking at food insecurity and hunger in the Campfire Burn Scar, heading today to Concow to hear from those working and living there who are trying to make a difference. If you are a campfire survivor who is having challenges getting healthy food for yourself or your family, please check out our food insecurity survey. You can find it on our website, mynspr.org. You can also share any of your thoughts with us on our message line, 433-9216. For Thursday, July 2nd, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, the latest news on COVID-19.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. The North State, a nearly coronavirus-free area at the end of March, is nearing 1,000 cases. Officials in Butte County announced a third person there had died from COVID-19, a person in their 80s fighting other chronic conditions. The death lifts fatalities across the 11-county region to a dozen. Butte County's caseload jumped to 206 Thursday after 17 more infections were confirmed. Sutter County health officials were reporting 197 cases, Shasta 129, Glenn 122, Yuba 94, Tehama 88, Colusa 70, Siskiyou 31, Lassen 15, Plumas 11, and Trinity County 2. Across the region, two dozen people are being treated in hospitals. A total of 965 North State residents have contracted the virus. Statewide, 240,195 Californians have contracted the coronavirus. 7,538 cases were confirmed Thursday. A total of 75 coronavirus-related deaths were recorded Thursday, pushing the total in California to 6,163. 300 hospital surge beds at four different facilities are being reactivated, the Governor's Office of Emergency Services announced late Wednesday. Three of the sites are in Southern California and one in the Bay Area. California's positivity rate, the percentage of COVID tests confirming an infection over the past 2 weeks, rose to 6.3% Thursday, Governor Gavin Newsom said at a noon press conference. Newsom said the rising figure is troubling and should concern everyone in the state.
It has been said that if you have your health, you have a million dreams. If you don't have your health, you have but one.
The number of Californians hospitalized with the virus has risen 56% in the past 2 weeks, and the number of patients in intensive care is up 49%. Newsom said the deteriorating conditions have prompted a new ad campaign to encourage mask usage. Initially in English and Spanish, the campaign will add additional languages and include broadcast, print media, and billboards. As many as 140 small businesses in Anderson, Redding, and Shasta Lake may each be eligible for a $5,000 grant to help them through the coronavirus crisis. To qualify, a business must have a brick-and-mortar presence, have fewer than 6 employees, been financially impacted by the pandemic, but not received a PPP loan or disaster funding from the Small Business Administration. For more information and to apply, visit the City of Redding's webpage and search for COVID-19 business grants. In other news, Caltrans is warning holiday weekend travelers to brace for major delays along Interstate 5 near Dunsmuir, where a bridge is being replaced. Traffic jams could delay northbound drivers as much as 4 hours Friday, and southbound travelers may face similar delays Sunday as the holiday weekend winds up. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. When the campfire first erupted more than a year and a half ago, on November 8, 2018, the first community it hit that morning was Concow. While people there were running for their lives, others not far away still had no clue about the devastation that was about to head their way. While first to be hit by the fire, in recovery, Concow seems to be last, with much of the help coming from those who live there and who lost everything themselves. Jesse Olson is a Concow resident who is also working with Team Rubicon USA. The nonprofit has been aiding in food recovery efforts in the burn scar, bringing food directly to people's homes. NSPR's Christian Solis recently spoke with Olson about what she's seeing as the biggest barriers to increasing food security as she's volunteering and in her own life.
The biggest barriers are going to be the shortage of accessible and affordable food. If you can't afford the food, that's going to be a big issue. Food is one of the most flexible items on a family's budget. So it's one of the ones that's most likely to be the last item to be of concern when bills are being paid. It's really difficult for people in lower wage jobs to provide for all of their family's needs. If there aren't any jobs, that's another issue too. Returning businesses to the burn scar is vital for decreasing food insecurity in the burn scar.
Can you tell me any post-fire specific barriers to increasing food access and security that you're seeing?
Gas expenses are huge. Propane expenses, the cost just to get your electricity, water, and septic inspected just so that you can get started with rebuilding is so far out of reach for so many people in the burn scar, especially those who were unable to acquire insurance. And now we're faced with being required to file a building permit by December or having to move our RVs that are on our own land. And this is a big concern for this community. It's not likely that most of the community is going to be able to do that. Most of the community doesn't have the insurance required to rebuild and are looking for alternative methods right now.
Since it's been getting hotter, I'm wondering, how does weather factor into food insecurity?
Oh, that's a huge impact. A lot of people were storing their food in lockable bins or things like that outside during the cold, which was nice. Can't do that now. Food spoils so fast in the heat. I just had a couple of bags of apples on the front porch for, I think, 2 days, and they had to go into compost. They were just gone. I don't know how many people I've met up here that don't have any way to air condition their homes because they don't have any power, and their generators that they have may be small generators because the RVs are older RVs. So the generator may not function properly. And so they now have smaller generators so that they can run some things. So they can run one thing at a time. They can run like a microwave or a blender or a toaster or a hairdryer, but they can't run them all at one time. And it definitely doesn't power their refrigerator. And it certainly won't power an air conditioning unit. So keeping fresh vegetables cool, it just doesn't do that. You have to get fresh vegetables almost on a daily basis unless you have some way to keep them refrigerated and cool. And then you've got to drive all the way into town for a fair-sized grocery store, 45 minutes to an hour away, every couple of days to get enough food just to support your family. For me, in my vehicle, it takes me $25 in gas every time I drive down the hill into Chico, and then another $25 back in gas just to go grocery shopping.
Having survived the campfire, what does it mean to you to be so involved in campfire recovery efforts?
I have a history of food insecurity myself from my childhood, and we are parents of three beautiful adopted boys. We used to be foster parents. So food insecurity has always been something that has been very, very important issue for us. Being a campfire survivor, that is really an important issue to me. Every day when I leave my property and drive down the road and wave at my neighbors, I'm just so heartbroken to see my community the way that it is. Almost no homes survived here in Kunkel. It's like a wilderness out here, and I want to see this community thriving again. I want to help my neighbors. I didn't have the ability to do it at the time that the fire happened. I wasn't ready or able emotionally to do that, but I am now, and I'm going to do what I can.
That was Jesse Olson, campfire survivor and resident of Concow, who is volunteering with Team Rubicon USA, speaking with NSPR's Christian Solis. Before the campfire, the nonprofit From the Ground Up Farms provided basic nutrition and gardening education to teach people how to cook and live off of their own garden. After the fire, their mission expanded to feeding fire survivors in and around the Concow area. Back in January, I spoke with the nonprofit's director, Jenny Lowry, as well as Jason Romer. Both are residents of Concow. The first thing I asked was if they could describe the state of food security in their community.
I'd have to say there is no food security in the area right now. Most people that lived up there had home gardens. They're all gone. It's 45 minutes to go to Chico or to Oroville to find a grocery store. So it's pretty insecure as far as food goes.
A lot of the giveaways are, you know, we're going to be here on this day for an hour. I mean, can you kind of talk about some of those things? Like the pop-up giveaways, I feel like that is hard for a lot of people.
It is hard for a lot of people. It's also hard for the people doing the giveaways. And I'm on both sides of this nightmare, and so I try and stay focused, and none of us know what we're doing. We've never done this before. There's help out there, but again, it comes back to the actual logistics. There is no place in Concow, really, to sit down and do a giveaway. So we get why some of them are happening in Paradise, because they have the available space. But I don't know. I understand everything that's going on. We're incredibly grateful for everything going on. I just think that we can do better.
Another serious barrier that we're dealing with in Concow area and other remote and rural areas like that is availability of information for a couple of different reasons. One reason is that a lot of older people are in the foothill areas who don't really use social media, which is most people's primary source for almost all of their information these days. So there's a big disconnect and a barrier there where people who are living out there just don't use or use regularly enough to be aware of these things happening, because that's how so most people find out that these giveaways are happening, that these clinics are happening and all that stuff. And then even for the people who are on social media or on the internet, there is extremely limited internet service in rural areas, which did not get any better post-fire, because the disruption of all the electricity systems throughout the rural area has also disrupted the availability of what limited internet service there was. So that's huge. A lot of people are just completely disconnected from the information about what's happening where, because they either A, don't use the internet, or can't get it where they live because of fire damage.
Again, that conversation was from January, so we recently reached out to Jenny Lowry again and spoke with her by phone. The first thing we asked was if anything at all has changed with food resources in Concow over the last 5 months. She said her nonprofit is now working with the Butte County Local Food Network to bring CSA boxes up to Concow that contain vegetables, meat, and eggs from the farmers market.
To the people receiving the help, it's changed a lot. The problem is, we just can't quite do enough.
In terms of the pandemic, she said, it's just made things harder.
It's scary. These people were barely making it. And then COVID shut everything down. They lost their jobs again. What building they were able to progress with has stopped. Money's gone. They're right back to where they were right after the fire because of the pandemic.
She said now, on top of fire recovery and the pandemic, we're going into summer, which means another wildfire season and PG&E's public safety power shutoffs that affect those who have gotten power back in the burn scar.
So what do you do when you've got $100 worth of groceries stuffed into your little tiny RV trailer because you can't go to town but once a month, and then they shut off your power? The food's gone. And this is the reality that these folks will live with now all summer long.
We also asked her what she wants people to know now that it's been more than a year and a half after the fire.
We still need help. We're still recovering. We are not following the models that say after 12 months, FEMA says everything should be okay after 12 months. This was a fire like no other. So it's going to be a recovery like no other. And we sure could use everybody to hang in there and help us.
That was Jenny Lowry with the nonprofit From the Ground Up Farms. You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. More just ahead.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Lindemood Bell Learning Centers, with instruction to help students catch up or get ahead in learning. Summer programs for reading, comprehension, and math. Learn more at lindemoodbell.com/NPR. And from Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting those working towards a day when no one has to choose between paying rent, putting food on the table, and protecting their health and the health of others. rwjf.org. From iDrive, providing cloud backup, full system backup, and on-site iDrive appliance to protect PCs, Macs, and servers from data loss due to crashes and ransomware. At iDrive.com/NPR. And from Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers from foodies to travelers. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA, NA.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. If there's one name you always hear when you go to CONCAO, it's Terry Rubiolo. She and her husband, John, have been feeding and helping their neighbors in the area long before the fire happened. A year and a half later, and after losing their own home, they're still feeding their community, with Terry making prepared meals out of a trailer that people can pick up and that they deliver. Their nonprofit, Iams Garden, is the one consistent place in the area where residents can get food and donations. I traveled there this week to catch up with Terry and a volunteer, Jeanette Carlisle, to check in on how things are going now. Terry said, since the pandemic, things have gotten worse.
A lot worse. We still got the same struggles with small space, and now it's even harder when people go to town because so much of the stuff they need is not available. And so trips are wasted.
It's like they got a double whammy. They got the fire, then they got this. So it's like, where do they go and what do they do? You know, they can't recover from the fire because they have this virus thing going on now. And it's just like, what do people do? They count on this lady right here so much. Without her, we wouldn't know what to do. She's wonderful.
Since we got our 501c3, we've had many more of the stores and stuff that have been able to help donate, but our need has increased. And the availability of the just the basic substantial foods is still hard to get, even though we're getting donations. Nobody's starving, but we're helping more people in a wider area of Butte County.
How many people are you, because you're still doing food deliveries as well, how many people are on your route right now?
We actually had to freeze our route. So we still got anywhere between 80 and 120, depending on, because we've got a couple of days a week that we do extra. But we had to stop taking, unless it's a emergency situation. Like, we just had a gentleman that had a stroke that we're going to go ahead and add him. But we've had to turn down others that have the ability to at least get here because we don't have enough drivers. We don't have enough time.
And how many days are you doing that?
3 days a week. Yeah. And 6 days a week, we cook here and people come here and pick up.
How many people are you feeding that way?
Anywhere from like 50 to 60, 70 people. Plus like the 80, like for deliveries on 3 days a week. So yeah, about 150, 200 people she feeds.
I'd say a little less, but she's close.
No. Yeah, it's close because she gets so busy at times. She doesn't realize who's all here. She just sees them coming and say, okay, they need that. And she goes in and makes them. And She doesn't calculate it.
Well, yeah, I'm calculating because I know my people. They yeah. come, okay, and I know this one's going to need three, that one's going to need five, you know what I'm saying?
And so this one can't have this, and this one can have that.
But I don't put it all together.
So you're even thinking about, like, allergies or food.
That yes. Yeah, I have yeah. people that don't eat pork. We have diabetics. I have people that don't eat gluten, you know, so... And I try to cater to those needs. You know,
so that's an extra thing that she has to do extra for them.
But I don't think about it. It's just cooking.
It's all in her mind. And she sees you walking through. And she goes, okay, this is what we got to do for that one. And she just gets right on it.
How important do you think that kind of attention is to meals for people?
Absolutely, absolutely necessary, because it's not just about what's in their dish. It's about knowing them. And that's what people need. That's where hope comes from.
Can you just tell me a little bit more about the people who you're delivering to and who come in for food? I mean, how many seniors do you have? I know that you had some folks who were seniors who maybe didn't have transportation, things like that.
Some of the seniors, but most of it's families. A lot of them are single women with children, but I take down to probably about 10 families, 10 or 12 families. And then we still have some in the motel down there that's been there since the fire. Some of them were up here in Concow that would love to come back, but they don't have the means to do it. So they're just wherever they can be right now to have a roof over their heads. Some of them, it's just a tent.
What, in Oroville?
Mm-hmm.
And is that a family or?
Yeah. I've got one family out there that's got a 6-week-old baby. She came home from the hospital back to her tent.
And this is more than a year and a half after the fire. Yeah. They're living in a tent with a baby.
Yes.
It's really a frustrating situation. Like, she's been on 211. She's been on these other sites. Yeah, we'll get to you. We can do this and do that. And she's still waiting because in the county buildings, they don't have enough people right now to be able to help these people in a quick manner. So they're put on a list. If the virus wasn't here, they'd have more people there and more people could get help faster. But it's just sit and wait. Three of the families that I deliver to, the kids, they'll see us pull up and they'll yell, "Grandma's here." They call me Grandma. So we always try to take, you know, them something a little special, like little goodies and stuff like that. Because, you know, it's hard on the parents. You can imagine how hard it is on the children.
I mean, I just don't understand. How are people falling through the cracks like that? It seems like there should be enough resources for people. So why isn't that happening? Why aren't they able to get connected?
What's happening is a lot of those people, unless they have somebody advocating for them, they're still waiting. Okay. So again, and some of them just don't have the ability, whether it was brought on by the fire or whether it was something that they already had. They don't have the ability to actually get on the phone and say, "Hey, I need this. Who do I talk to?" There's a lot of that out there. Then you've got the other side where even when they do, they're put on the bottom of the list. That takes time. And then you have a lot of those that it sounds silly, but they got denied by FEMA. And so they don't think they have any recourse. You know what I'm saying? They don't understand that the denial, because we were denied, that the denial has nothing to do with being able to get help. It was just, that's how FEMA dealt with them at the time. And I've been dealing with a lot of people that have been, "Well, we got turned down." So yes, and you know,
there's still doors out there that's opened for you.
Just not a lot.
Get them in them.
Yeah, not a lot of communication. You know, to actually, they didn't say when they got denied FEMA, "But here's other resources. Use these." They were just sent a letter that says you've been denied, and so they figured, okay, end of story. I got no help, so they haven't sought help. And then there's always your stubborn ones that just don't seek help, you know. So, like I said, again, a lot of contributing factors to that.
What still needs to be done? What are the biggest things that still need to be done?
Nothing's changed. So it's the same needs. And there's pretty much zero building. I'm still waiting for my permit just for my steel building, which came with all the plans. It wasn't like we had to draw them up and there's mistakes, you know. And we're still waiting for that, you know. There's just rural growth is not happening. Rural rebuilding is not happening. I think I know of two houses that they got okayed, but they're in the process of milling their wood. So the construction hasn't begun yet.
So. They say the virus is slowing down people getting the permits and stuff because a lot of the buildings are closed. You can't go in and do them. So it's holding people up here.
So just to meet the basic needs right now and try not to let people get depressed is a good word over it. I mean, that's a lot of what we do. We're just here to listen. You know, we really do care. And sometimes just putting it out there, your story or what you're going through at the moment, or
you've got people that just come up that just need somebody to talk to because they have nobody and it's all in their head and they need to talk to it, try to get it sorted out. They sit and they talk with her, they get it worked out and they walk away with a smile.
Yeah, there's no better way to put it, but I'm just saying that. So just meeting basic needs is still number one.
That was Terry Rubiolo and Jeanette Carlisle with IAM's Garden. Before we end this program, I want to highlight two things that we heard. It's that basic needs, like food, are still essential in Concow and other areas of the burn scar, and that residents there still very much need help. If you would like to assist or support this community or others still recovering from the fire, all the voices you heard today work for nonprofits that take donations and some volunteers. You can learn more about each of these and others on our website, mynspr.org. This has been the fourth of five episodes on hunger in the campfire burn scar. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call on our message line, 433-9216. The series was produced by Christian Solis and Sarah Bohannon as a project for the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism Impact Fund. Thanks to Eric Rodeville and Kylo Castilla for additional editing support. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay vigilant. We are seeing an increase in coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, and deaths happening in our region right now. Saturday is my brother's birthday, and I will not be spending it with him in person due to the virus. I hope you will also take care to heed public health guidelines by not gathering, to protect your loved ones this 4th of July holiday weekend too.